Hey everybody, welcome back to No More Silos. My name is Erica Santiago and this is my podcast on cultural Christianity, where I hope I'm tearing down those silos, breaking down those silos, helping you deconstruct and decompartmentalize history, church history, Christianity, your faith, what you believe and understand about the Bible, all of those things. And so welcome back to our first episode of No More Silos in the new year. It is 2022, y'all. Today we're going to be talking about secular humanism. It is a topic that I have looked into quite a bit the last few years, and it recently came up again in a conversation I was having with a friend about a documentary that she recommended, and I remembered that I had written a paper on it. So I'll share a little bit from that paper, not all of it because it's not that exciting, but just enough for you to understand, because I think it's something that in today's environment, as more and more people are trying to understand their faith and trying to deconstruct what is culture, what is Christianity, what am I leaving the church because of something that's in the Bible that I disagree with, or am I leaving the church because, or upset with the church, maybe I don't want to leave, maybe I'm just, I disagree with something, but am I disagreeing with something that is culturally based, that somebody made up and taught that, and now I'm upset about it, or the fruit of whatever was taught because it was something that was made up, didn't have the lasting fruit that Jesus talks about in the Bible. So anyway, welcome back to No More Silos. Again, my name is Erica Santiago. I hope that you are subscribing or following us on your favorite podcast outlet. If you're on iTunes, I think it's follow or subscribe. If you are on Spotify, I definitely think it is follow. And then, of course, there's Amazon, so that you can tell your robot in your house, I won't say the name or mine will turn on, who will play this podcast wherever it is you're listening to your podcast. So I'm excited that you're here. I'm excited that you're still listening to me, because we are now to the point where this has been going on for a couple of years. And so I'm super excited. I am and very, very humbled and appreciative of all of you who are listening both in the United States and abroad. And so that's pretty exciting to me when I check the stats. So let's get started. Today, like I said, we're talking about secular humanism. But of course, because this is sort of kind of like a Bible study, we got to start with scripture, right? And we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 16. There's a question that's found there. And because I like to read things in context, we're going to look at what comes just before that question and kind of talk about it first. Jesus once asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am?" Jesus asks this question. And his disciples at that point had been hanging out with him for a while now, right? They'd seen him do a bunch of miracles and heal people and teach. And so they had a lot to say about that. And that kind of brings us to our question today, is who do you say Jesus is? Because I think fundamentally and foundationally, that's the question around secular humanism. That's what gets people to leave the church, because we're not all on the same page about who we think Jesus is. Matthew 16 says this, and I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. It has a little heading in it, the demand for a sign. And chapter 16 begins like this. "The Pharisees and Sadducees came, and to test Jesus, they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. He answered them, 'When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times.'" Hey, that's a Prince album. "An evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. Then he left them and went away." Now, the demand for a sign, that struck me. And I thought about this and I looked it up. And my first thing I thought about was Jonah, the sign of Jonah, right? And for me, I think of Jonah in the whale of the fish, and he's running from God. Like, how he gets to that point is he is given instructions by God to do one thing, and he goes and he does another. He's like, I don't want to do that. So he's running to avoid God. That was what I looked at. But actually, the way the commentaries see this is the sign is that Jonah is in the belly of the fish, the whale, for 3 days and three nights, and it's really pointing to the resurrection. I was like, oh, yeah, well, okay, that makes sense. So the sign that Jesus says will show up, or that we'll see, is the sign of Jonah. He's pointing to the resurrection. And then he leaves them and he walks away. Verse 5, there's another little subtitle here. It says, the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And it says, when the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. They said to one another, it is because we have brought no bread. And becoming aware of it, Jesus said, you of little faith, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered, or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gathered? How could you fail to perceive that I was not speaking about bread? Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then they understood that he had not told them to beware of the yeast of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so, without going deep into who the Pharisees and the Sadducees were, they were the religious leaders, the scholars of the time, and they give Jesus a hard time, like, all the way through the Gospels. One, because it's like, on the one hand, they knew the Messiah was coming. If anybody knew, they knew. And two, I guess when you know somebody is what you're waiting for, and they don't come quite the way that you expect them to, you're a little annoyed. And so they keep picking at Jesus throughout all of this. But when Jesus is talking about, you know, we're thinking about yeast and bread, Jesus is the bread of life. When we think of Passover and the unleavened bread without yeast, the symbol here is the church leaders like to add extra stuff that does nothing for you. And that's why when I think about secular humanism, first, I think about we're not all on the same page about who Jesus is. If we were, then half their arguments would go away. And two, the people who were in charge of making sure people understood who God is were not good at not adding extra random stuff that wasn't helpful, and that's the yeast. And so yeast is used figuratively here as a corrupting substance, hypocrisy. Okay, so now that brings us towards the end of the chapter, where we get to Peter's declaration about Jesus. Now, verse 13, Matthew chapter 16, verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, but others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So, oh my gosh, Jesus is like admitting that he's the Messiah, but he tells his disciples, shh, don't tell anybody. I don't want anybody to know. It could cause problems before I'm ready for these problems to be dealt with. But here's the interesting thing about this moment about identity from the standpoint of Christ and of us as believers or followers of Jesus. We see this in Paul's letter, in Ephesians chapter 2. And my commentary resource that I was looking at for this passage in general observes that Jesus and his disciples had a moment here to really be reflective about who he was or who he is to them. And I think that's where we want to start 2022. Who is Jesus to you? Here at No More Silos, we think about how we compartmentalize so much in our lives. We have our church friends and our gym friends, and well, I don't actually go to the gym, but I've heard stories. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, we have all these, like, our work friends, our school friends, our gym friends, our family. And because of the pandemic, we have had to kind of live with no more silos in our lives because we're doing everything at home. We're working from home. We're working out from home. Some of us are going to school from home. And so everything is here. And I want to carry that on into 2022 in taking down those silos and say, who do you think Jesus is? Who is he to you? One of the challenges of cultural Christianity is identity. Who do I think that I am? Who do I identify with? Am I evangelical, African-American? Am I Democrat or Republican? What tribe of American modernity do I belong to? Have I paused to take the time to really evaluate who am I and who do I think Jesus is? So as I was mentioned a moment ago, recently a friend recommended that I watch a documentary that was on Amazon about the Black church in America. And it turned out it was a kind of poorly produced collection of severely edited interviews of people who were not the right people to ask the questions they were asking. And in some of the people, it seemed like they were caught off guard with the questions, like the interviewer was asking them to interview them about something else, and they said okay, and then like question number three was a gotcha question. So it was that kind of a documentary. But what was interesting about it is that I think I had seen it before and forgotten about it, like I put it out of my mind. But I'm glad that I saw it again because they were asking really good questions. They were legit good questions. But they weren't asking the right people about the state of the Black church in urban areas. They consistently didn't ask church leaders, like actual church leaders, but people who the media might point to when a church-related issue might come up. For example, they interviewed Martin Luther King III. He doesn't currently, and I don't know that he ever has, held like a leadership role in a church to be asking him a question about the effects of the Black church in urban settings. He's a civil rights leader, yes, but he's not the go-to person to ask about poverty in an urban Black church, inner city church in America. I don't think that's his wheelhouse or his lane. The people who were interviewed with the most airtime, though, and this was what really kind of caught my attention, the people who were interviewed with the most airtime in this documentary were actually secular humanists or atheists. Again, not their lane either to ask these questions, but obviously they have something to say about the effectiveness of the Christian faith in general. And so I do not begin this discussion of secular humanism to condemn, but to provide our No More Silos listeners, to provide you with information so that we can empathize and show compassion for people who are on a deconstructing journey that has actually led them away from Christ. And Stephen Covey talked about seeking to understand. He also talked about beginning with the end in mind. And so I want us to take some time to understand what is secular humanism, understand why people would, their journey for deconstruction might lead them away from the church, and provide you with resources to kind of give those answers. My favorite resource, and I did a whole episode early on in the podcast, is Paul's response in Acts chapter 17. He clearly understood the religion of the Romans. He was a Roman citizen, but he was also a Pharisee. He was a trained Pharisee. He was a trained theologian of the Torah. And he used that knowledge to apologetically defend and present the gospel of Jesus Christ. How was he able to do that? Not just as a follower of Christ saying, well, my Jesus is better than whatever you're doing, but he actually lays it out for them in Acts chapter 17. So I encourage you to go back and listen to that episode or read Acts 17 for yourself. In short, though, secular humanists are people who believe that people can be good and do good things without God. It's kind of that simple. But to make their argument, they unfortunately often seem to find the worst representations of the church in order to explain or justify why their philosophy works for them. So it's in order for secular humanists to argue their point about who they are and what they believe or don't believe, they have to juxtapose that against the failings of the fruit of the church. And in this video, in this documentary, they were specifically pointing to the black urban church setting. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Watching this documentary, I was concerned that none of the interviewees or church people profiled questioned what Christians believe according to the Bible. They only focused on the fruit of what happens, and they just assumed that they were doing what was in the Bible. That was the implication. But they never actually asked even the church people that they did profile. There was one pastor that they talked to explain how what was happening was inconsistent with scripture, with Christian scripture. And so the misrepresentations that they gave actually looked like some of these churches were like cults, because there was no evidence that they were following Jesus. And I'm going to do a whole other episode on spiritual formation and discipleship again. Well, continuing our conversation on discipleship and talk about that. But so the argument that they make in this documentary is faulty, which leads me to something I saw on social media the other day. And it's actually a quote that I think they've posted before from the Jude 3 Project. But it's such a powerful quote by Lisa Fields that they posted it again on social media. She says this. She says, "Some millennials resent church because their parents were good at church but not good at life. They struggle attending a place that consumed their parents' time but never transformed their private life." I'll say that one more time, because that leads us not only to what we're talking about with the secular humanists in this documentary, but also to what our next podcast episode is going to be about, talking about transformation and spiritual growth. Some millennials resent church because their parents were good at church but not good at life. They struggle attending a place that consumed their parents' time but never transformed their private life. My husband talked about how Generation X and later generations don't set church up as a priority, but he didn't grow up in church, so he has a very different perspective of his faith. He became a Christian as an adult. So for those of us who grew up in church, we know people or knew people who were really good at church, showed up every Sunday, served maybe in a leadership or some capacity like usher, choir member, but their lives Monday through Saturday were like a train wreck, or just not generally indicative of their faith, not modeling Christian faith according to what's actually in the Bible. They didn't demonstrate life change or transformation. And this is why discipleship is so important to me now, not just for my kids, but because too many Christians are not modeling actual Christianity. And I really believe that's what leads people away from Jesus. So back to talking about identity, Jesus asked this question, "Who do you say that I am?" And so our question today in this episode is, who do you say that Jesus is? But a couple of years ago, Jamar Tisby wrote about why or what was amiss in the self-identification of evangelicals as Republicans. And so for some people, it is, and this was so in Jesus's time in the first century, some people were looking for Jesus to come as a politician, to deal with the political environment or the economic environment. And so there are folks today who their Christianity is very closely tied or merged or blended or whatever with their identity with a particular political party. Jamar Tisby wrote this in 2017 in this article. He says, "White evangelicals have to untangle why those beliefs usually form and shape people to be politically conservative and Republican. Until this culture changes, the political patterns of white evangelicals are not likely to shift in the near future." Now, what's interesting about this, what we know now in 2022, and thanks to Kristen Dumay and to Jamar Tisby's book, The Color of Compromise, and Kristen Dumay's book, Jesus and John Wayne, that gives an actual history, articulates a whole history of why the beliefs of white evangelicals in the United States send people into a world of political conservatism or being a Republican, and that political conservatism actually aligns with the anti-desegregation political environment of the mid to late 1970s. Desegregation started in the 60s, yes, but as it promulgated around the South, it was really in the 70s that it ultimately became a problem. And one of the points that really struck me and stood out to me the most in Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby is when he talked about how the Carter administration in the late 70s basically said to all the private schools in the South that were basically created to avoid having to, for people to avoid having to send their kids to desegregated schools, that they no longer could maintain their nonprofit status as a church or adjacent to a church ministry because they were not desegregating. And it was federal law that you had to be desegregated. And so if you weren't going to play by the federal law rules, you don't get the federal law tax break, which totally makes sense. But that is also why I think Carter lost the presidency the next roll of the dice. So that said, Jamar Tisby goes on in the article to ask the question about what it is that they believe. Like, what? How do they take their faith and apply that to their political beliefs if there isn't somebody standing there giving them teaching that is not actually biblical, so that they, but telling them it is? And that's where I think the issue with secular humanism comes into play as well, and where the issue with the folks that made that documentary about the problems in the Black church in inner city also had this problem, because the orthodoxy versus orthopraxy question had come up. You know, you can't separate theology and practice. It just can't be separated. Even Jesus said, "You will know my disciples by their behavior." So that begs the question, are these people really followers of Christ? Someone made the observation recently that if I check off the box African-American or Black, but I'm not really Black, but I send this in to the Census Bureau, does that make me Black? The issue is self-identification. What identity do I attach myself to, and how important is what I choose to the larger conversation of race, religion, or politics? We live in a culturally Christian society. And in the southern states where I live, most people will identify as Christian even if they don't own a Bible and never went to church. So where does that leave the pollsters? Where does that leave the documentarians? They're talking to the fringe or extremists in our culture who have chosen to identify themselves in a way that actually contradicts who they really are. Our schools don't teach critical thinking or civics, so people are genuinely unaware that they're probably checking the wrong box. So Tisby, in this article, though, from 2017, discusses a book by sociologists Michael Emerson and Christian Smith that contends that evangelical beliefs lead to a certain view of how the nation should be governed, and the book is called Divided by Faith. The authors speak of a religio-cultural toolkit that defines the limits of evangelical political imagination. And so what they say in here, and Jamar Tisby kind of breaks it down and summarizes it, they give these three tools that white evangelicals use to parse racial issues in America. And it, of course, impacts the way that they vote. And I would extend that to say that it's not necessarily limited to white evangelicals. I think it's also a big part of secular humanism. People who say they don't believe in God, but they appreciate the structure, infrastructure of community of the church model. So these three tools are accountable free will individualism, relationalism, and anti-structuralism. Let's take each tool in turn, and I'm going to share with you what Jamar Tisby wrote in the article in defining them. Accountable free will individualism means individuals exist independent of structures and institutions, have free will, and are individually accountable for their own actions. This idea stems from the idea that personal sin and the consequences thereof don't really, it's me and my sin. Like, I didn't own slaves, therefore I am not responsible for what slavery has left as a legacy in the United States, for example. So the evangelical emphasis on individualism reduces the importance of communities and institutions to the way people think and behave. Relationalism is a strong emphasis on interpersonal relationships. And this idea comes from the primacy of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ in evangelical belief. The fundamental problem of humanity is alienation from God, though. The connection between creator and creature can only be restored through an individual decision to accept Christ as Lord and establish a saving personal relationship with him. Solutions to America's issues will not be offered through an impersonal government, but only through building healthy one-on-one connections, first with God and then with neighbors. And then finally, anti-structuralism refers to the belief that invoking social structures shifts guilt away from its root source, the accountable individual. So systems, structures, and policies are not to blame for the problems of America. They come from harmful choices of individuals. So there's no generational structural explanation for racial inequality or other social ills. And so that kind of leads us to me where secular humanism then comes into play, because secular humanism isn't a black thing or a white thing. There's folks from all walks of life who participate in this philosophy. A few years ago, we had a family join our church that was excited to join. One of the reasons that they said they kept coming back was our children's ministry, because we actually taught the kids the Bible. They thought that that was like amazing. And I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, doesn't everybody do that? But I didn't realize until a few years after, when I was scrolling around on social media, and an apologist that I follow wrote an article called How Sunday Schools Are Raising the Next Generation of Secular Humanists. And this was probably around the same time that I was studying apologetics in school for my master's in divinity, and also around the same time that I was doing a teaching on Ephesians in our church's Bible study. And so I'm sitting there thinking, you know, on the one hand, doesn't everybody teach the Bible, actually teach the Bible? I mean, some of our most famous evangelists on TV, televangelists, always say, you know, obviously you can't join my church wherever I'm at, but please go and find a Bible teaching church to go to. And I didn't really consider how hard that actually was. So when I looked into it later, and I want to share with you the actual quote from the article. She says, secular humanism in our churches is preparing our children to be good without God as adults. We are not actively teaching the mystery of the gospel effectively to combat against the prevailing culture outside our doors. And so the question I had then was, well, what needs to change? And how do we change the conversation? Certainly Ephesians, Paul's letter to the church at Ephesus, is all about raising the bar in the Ten Commandments and how to live as a Christian and how to love others and love God and be a part of the community. But it's interesting that people began to realize something was amiss in our churches, that some churches were not teaching Bible, but they were teaching culture. And so, interestingly enough, around 2018, or around the same time, I came across this other article in The Atlantic, Students Suing for a Constitutional Right to Education. A new federal complaint with a unique argument accuses the state of Rhode Island of failing to provide students with the skills they need to participate effectively in democracy. And then we have January 6th. And so all this led to, or all this was kind of floating around in my head when I was working on my MDiv a few years ago and had to research the topic of secular humanism. It came up in my apologetics class and I had to talk about it. And so here's some of what I wrote. And I'm going to kind of blow through some of this pretty quickly and skip around a bit because it was quite a long paper. And some of it, honestly, was filler sentences because, you know, it was for school. But summary, the summary of the worldview. So when we look at a worldview, worldview has to do with perspective. How do I see the world? What filter do I see the world through? Is it rose-colored glasses? Do I agree that the sky is blue? Do I agree on certain basic truths about the world around me? And at what point do I diverge from the others in my community? And so to the secular humanist, the source of ultimate authority is reason. Everything can be explained. Reason, according to this worldview, is really one person's opinion. True reason, according to this definition, can't ever really be attained. The skeptical nature of the secular humanist doesn't allow for a transcendent understanding or encounter with the living God, but rather a core belief in the physical world around them. It was mainly the Greek motive of matter and form which directed the thought of Plato and Aristotle, resulting in a dualistic view of the relationship between a so-called material body and rational soul. I did a whole episode on why is Aristotle teaching your Bible study. Again, it's a matter of taking that filter of worldview, right? So interestingly, the source of morality for secular humanists is generally based on the world's most popular religions. Get that? However, they themselves do not notice this and believe themselves to have an inherent morality compass within themselves. Secular humanists seek to break with the past and to expunge the signs of religion from society and its workings, especially where those signs have political and legal weight. This break with the past is really a repackaging of something like religion, but not religious, placing their faith in nature and seeking relevancy against the foil of Christianity. Most secular humanists are culturally Christian or come from a Christian or Judeo-Christian background, so theoretically, much of their belief system follows the definition of a theology, but their claim is that they are not a religion. One of the things that I discovered in my research was that there were like churches or groups, like small groups, what we would think of small groups in the church, set up in places like in Europe and in the United States, where people gathered. They had like a potluck. They did projects, they did a study or had a pep talk. Somebody came and gave them a motivational speech instead of a sermon. Or then they had did outreach. You know, maybe they fed people at a local soup kitchen, or they did something for the community. And I'm sitting there going, that's what churches do. And if you study the history, charity, the way that we know it today, didn't exist before Christianity. Nobody was going out to the edges of town picking up the abandoned babies before the Christians were really doing it. Nobody was going out making sure that everybody in their community had something to eat or housing or healthcare or whatever it was that was helpful to them. One of the people that the disciples post-resurrection resurrect, that's in the book of Acts, Damaris, I think her name was, she was someone who was doing so much for the community that it was her character of that really made people go, hey, we need to go find one of those Jesus guys to raise her back from the dead. We need her. We need her to be living. And so that happens in the book of Acts. So anyway, secular humanism historically is linked to Unitarian and Universalist ideas from the 18th century New England. I've been to New England, and you will find churches that are Unitarian and Universalist, and they look like churches. Anyway, the secular humanist claim to truth varies based on the individual's assessment of evidence available and understood. According to this worldview, evidentiary proof can be found in nature. This worldview shuns emotional outlooks but stresses reason to avoid irrational outcomes. What's interesting is that it was the emotional display of the Black church worship experience that was problematic for the people in this documentary that I was looking at. And so it is the tension between the objective and subjective understandings of reason and how this relates to happiness as both a pleasure and a purpose, heart and head, that we find many humanists today. Arguably, contemporary physics has made it even harder for self-described materialists or physicalists to suppose their concept of matter or the physical is stable. The secular humanist believes in the divinity of the individual. There is no life after the one lived in the present. The secular humanist believes they can be ethically moral without God or a God while living their lives based on reason grounded in the present. The practicing humanist believes in finding happiness in the pleasures available in the world, both physical and mental, not really spiritual, that allows them to be satisfied with their present. Morality is viewed as secular on the basis of personal integrity and perceived honesty with oneself. And so recent observers have noted that the term religious atheism has been used to describe secular humanism. There's the idea that God is secondary to the faith in reason. The secular humanist sets for themselves the goal of living life well with the focus on imminent or immediate values without seeking some transcendent good reference point as one gets in a theistic religion. And so what we're finding is that in order to define or redefine their belief system, they have to speak about it against the foil of the religious in the Western world, and particularly Christianity. And so if you're coming from a deconstructed, I left the black church, you're going to focus on the black church as a problem. If you're coming deconstructing from the white evangelical church or a mainline denomination, then they're the problem. And so in not believing in God or a higher power controlling the universe, as a regular atheist believes, secular humanists look at it as a way to define themselves, and they're a little bit more open-minded and a little bit more appreciative of the merits of religion, but what they're looking for is an emphasis on ethics and the need to build communities around a recognition of everyone's shared humanity in a way that can provide meaning, identity, and belonging. Which is interesting because they're looking to natural law and human dignity, which is in Genesis. It's God created the heavens and the earth. We worship the creator. They're focusing on worshiping the created and then talking about how our dignity as humans is inherent. Well, yes, it is inherent because we're made in the image of God. And that is where our dignity comes from. So again, I'm not here to condemn their worldview. I'm really here to help us all kind of understand where they're coming from. Like I said, it's a filter that they're looking at, but it comes out of the foundation where there was a departure from faith that created a rift within the scientific community during the Enlightenment period of history. The Enlightenment period happened in the 16th, 17th century, around the same time the United States was being formed. And so there's a lot that kind of overlaps here. And that's why, as I've been reading the 1619 Project, I'm having all these aha moments. Looking at spiritual formation and the way that our identity as Americans has been formed, because in practice, the humanist believes that finding happiness, the pursuit of happiness in the pleasures available in the world, both physical and mental, not really spiritual, is what allows them to be satisfied with their present. Several episodes back, I talked about Thomas Jefferson's adventure with his Bible and an X-Acto knife. He cut out all the spiritual stuff, all the supernatural things. He cut that out of his Bible and he just kept the things that seemed real to him. And this is the guy who in his, I think he was in his early 30s, wrote about the pursuit of happiness as our ideal. This is why we're declaring independence from Great Britain, because we want to pursue happiness as we see fit. And so the challenge to thriving in a contemporary religious society has brought the secular humanists to a point where they've made significant changes in their strategy and their self-understanding, leading to a worldview that is increasingly consistent in many ways with the Christian worldview, except for their belief in God. What does that tell us? That tells us that we have a chance in talking with with our friends who subscribe to secular humanism as their philosophy. Isn't that great news? I think it's great news. I think that helps us with understanding. Because for the Christian, the ultimate reality is God and our relationship with Him that is predicated on love. Christianity is our worldview that we choose because it invites believers to engage in a relationship with the creator of the universe based upon love and free will. And it does not look for happiness, but in finding joy that is sustainable in every situation. And that's the difference. Humanist is looking for happiness in the moment because they're only living in this present. Christians find joy that is sustainable in every situation because we know we are planning to live beyond this present. The Christian worldview is more than simply learning about God and applying the commands of the Bible to our daily lives in a way that demonstrates love for fellow human beings. It's really about that relationship with God predicated on love. And, you know, and then the question that often comes back at us is the problem of evil. Well, what about evil? And it's often pointed out in the humanist rejection of the relationship humankind has with God. And their logic suggests that God does not exist because evil exists. But the reality of the Christian relationship with God, however, can be apologetically explained through God's plan for redeeming humankind through the sacrifice of his son, Jesus. The Christian worldview accepts that we are image bearers of God, and it is his character found in the scriptures that we follow. Now, I want to point that out, that it's God's character that we're following in the scriptures, focusing on the New Testament, and I'll talk about this on the next episode when we talk about spiritual formation, but that just because there's crazy stuff that jumps off in the Old Testament in the narratives of what happened with Israel, that doesn't necessarily mean that's in something we're supposed to go do ourselves. And so I want to make sure that we're clear about that, because a lot of times when people are like anti-Bible, they'll talk about some wacky thing that happens in the Old Testament. And it's like, well, yeah, but God didn't tell nobody to do that. That they did that on their own. And look what trouble it caused. But anyway, I digress. Living in the truth of Christianity involves being on an adventure as part of God's bigger plan and purpose. And so we look at history as a way to learn from the positive as well as the negative outcomes. That's the whole Old Testament, right? We look at the positive outcomes, and then we look at the negative outcomes, and we go, oh, note to self, don't do that. The Christian legacy has largely been ignored, and instead, humanist theories are selectively espoused. The application of serving others and love is increasingly found in the area of modern social work as the early Christian principles are redeployed and claimed by Christians. And so a lot of the things that we have done over the centuries as Christians that helps people, helps our community, have been repackaged, and someone else has come along and said, oh, I've got this great idea, I'm going to do this. And it's like, okay, yeah, the church used to do that, or we used to do that. That used to be part of what we did as just followers of Jesus. And so it helps if we understand that history. And the other really important point that I think that is a primary reason that Christianity spread so quickly, and I've said this before and on occasion, is the significance around the resurrection. The historical facts of the death, the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances of Jesus, while requiring some degree of context for the modern believer or non-believer to understand, provides substantive proof of the resurrection. The death by extreme beating, carrying the large cross itself, the physicality of the crucifixion, and the other sources for historical Jesus and Roman executions in general offers evidence. Not only that, but it's outlined repeatedly with very little difference in any of the Gospels, the ones that made it into the canon and even the ones it didn't. The empty tomb has a few different angles to understanding, including who owned the tomb and their relationship to the process of Jesus's death and burial, the witness of the women before the burial and after the resurrection, and all those stories that have support for them, and even the alternative stories that had no support. Everyone pretty much in the first century agreed Jesus died and he rose again. Like, people saw him, people engaged with him, they ate with him, they spoke with him, they spent time with him post-resurrection, and they told other people. That was the whole point of the word witness, which the word martyr actually means witness who died because they told people about what happened. So the primary reason that Christianity spread so quickly, and Paul attests to this as well in his letters, is people were eyewitnesses to the resurrection and told others about it. So it wasn't like they didn't see it happen. The other large key point in generating significance around the resurrection is the transformation of Jesus's closest disciples into evangelists and apostles. They had scattered and effectively gave up on Jesus once he was arrested. Only the truth in his resurrection could have brought everybody back together again. Now, the women didn't leave, but the guys did. But that's a different Bible study lesson. And caused all of them to speak boldly about the resurrected Savior again. And the third point of significance in discussing the resurrection is that the naturalist approach fails as its own methodology does not support the evidence of the alternative to the resurrection story. And this is simply the best defense to naturalism, as their evidential philosophy cannot satisfy their own requirements. One of the reasons, as a homeschool parent, that I make sure all of my kids take this, go through this course on how to make a good argument, how to understand logic, because you have to be ready to explain what you believe and why you believe it. And while Western culture is slowly reassessing our understanding of history and facts or truths offered by the systems that define our culture, and this movement progresses, the truth of Jesus' resurrection is growing, leaving the secular humanists asking more questions about what they believe. And everyone wants to belong to something. This has become part of our culture in America, and exactly the opening for the secular humanists to copy the strategy and structure of evangelism efforts of the Christian church. It fails as a worldview precisely because it doesn't adhere to a complete and thorough perspective on living life, and its goal of happiness leaves the depressed person without hope that is found in Christ, a gathering that mirrors the small group ecclesia of the church, including an outreach project, is insufficient. Following a worldview that requires only a physical perspective but allows for faith in evolution or the Big Bang theory leaves the adherent wanting more. So their theories, their philosophies, and ideas ultimately cannot be supported and are easily refuted, and reason is insufficient to base one's life philosophy. So, why does secular humanism continue to thrive in American churches? Well, I think there's a few reasons. One is we live in a pluralistic society. Americans, we readily embrace mix and match religion. I've talked about that before here on the podcast. We are all over syncretism. Another reason is that we don't really understand all the time the historical reason behind our ideal of separation of church and state. Our history of separating church and state is in response to not wanting the ruling monarch to claim themselves to be divine representatives of God on earth. Google divine right king, Louis XIV. Louis XIV lived in the 17th century, also known as Louis the Great or the Sun King. He was the king of France from 1643 until his death in 1715. He reigned like 72 years on Wikipedia. But what's important to know about this time frame is his absolute rule was based on his belief that he was ordained by God to be king. Our American Revolution is a response politically to European monarchs who believed they were the head of the church and their country. This is what separation of church and state actually meant in 1776. It wasn't that they just didn't want to have control of the king. They really wanted to say the king can be politically head of the country, but not head of what we believe. And when you consider, you got guys exacto knifing their Bibles and taking out all the supernatural parts, there's a distinct difference in what the politicians believed versus what regular people believed and what the king or believed. So Louis's absolute rule was based on his belief that he was a divine right king, that he was ordained by God to be king. This is why it's hard for Americans to follow King Jesus. We have a cultural disdain for monarchies, but a strange obsession with the British royal family as celebrities. I mean, I was watching the Today Show today, and they were all over the fact that it was Princess Kate's birthday, and she turned 40, and it's like, who cares? That's not our country, but we're obsessed with it, so they're like celebrities. It's interesting. When we think of our mix-and-match religions, think about this. You might think, oh, I don't mix and match religion, but do you reference karma? Do you, because that's not a Christian concept. Do you embrace yoga in your culture? I'm all for stretching and meditation, but I have to draw the line at some of the practices because I'm like, am I practicing somebody else's religion and not Christianity? I want to be real clear that I'm not doing that. And it's not that it's words that don't mean anything. Maybe they don't mean anything to you, but yeah. So we mix and match, right? Think about how we talk about spirituality or sage and meditation even. I think on this next episode, as I've talked through this today, I really think I'm going to talk about spirituality and spiritual formation on our next No More Silos episode, because I think it's a topic worth exploring. Because, and here's the thing, the fight in our schools about critical race theory and the 1619 Project, as I said, I'm currently reading that, by the way, and I want to share my thoughts on how the silo that is the 1619 Project and critical race theory is another silo that's not actually being taught in schools. But looking at our history and understanding why we think the way we do, what is our cultural perspective? How do we get to a point where we have a misunderstanding of what is happening in the church because we don't know church history and how the church responded in 1619 or 1750 or 1776 or 1803. All of these things are things that are covered in Jamar Tisby's book, The Color of Compromise, because that is exactly what his book is about, how the church missed opportunities to be the church because white supremacy prevailed. It's playing out right now in our white evangelical churches, as well as black churches, as more Generation Xers and millennials are disassociating themselves with the traditional black church or any church for that matter. And so that brings me back to the Lisa Fields quote. Some millennials resent church because their parents were good at church but not good at life. They struggle attending a place that consumed their parents' time but never transformed their private life. Christianity is about a life transformed. Anything short of that, they're probably not teaching you actual Christianity. It might be something else. Those guys that produced that documentary that have left the church for secular humanism probably had bad examples or bad models of Christianity. And instead of asking questions about the Orthodox faith based on scripture, they instead attacked the fruit of people claiming to be Christians. There's a book that I'm reading for my class this semester as I'm working on the doctorate in ministry. It's called The Complete Book of Discipleship by Bill Hull. And he writes in chapter one, because that's kind of all I've read so far, he writes about non-discipleship Christianity, non-discipleship Christianity. And he defines it as people who call themselves Christians, but don't actually submit to or follow Jesus, according to what's actually in the Bible. Religious consumerism is the fruit of such a faith, a focus on individualism over community. Last semester I had a project, and I'm that nerdy person that buys their books ahead of time. So I sent out this survey last semester for a project I was working on, and I asked respondents if they agreed or disagreed with the following statement that was actually out of Hull's book. And he says this on page 43, he says, "Believing without discipleship isn't believing. It's agreeing to a set of facts about a religious figure." Believing without discipleship isn't believing. It's agreeing to a set of facts about a religious figure. So let me preface this with a few details about my survey. My survey only had 18 people respond, and out of that, 4 didn't even respond to that question. 28.57% said that they somewhat agreed. And then I had those who kind of strongly agreed, and then I had some that strongly disagreed. And then I had a few comments on Facebook where I posted it from friends who weren't really sure if they agreed or disagreed with the statement, but without context, weren't sure they liked the implications of the statement. This is why I think discussing spiritual formation is a good topic for an upcoming episode. I think as American or Western or Global North Christians, we don't like to be challenged in our comfort or complacency in our beliefs. But then people like the folks in the documentary and their secular humanist friends come along and kick us in the shins. When I Googled the documentary, I came across a blog post that reviewed it. And the documentary is actually called Contradiction, A Question of Faith. And the producer, Jeremiah Camera, explores whether or not the Black church and the Christian religion has been beneficial or harmful to us. Now, again, like I said, I think these are legit questions. The reviewer poses 5 questions that he got out of watching this video. He says that the producers ask interviewees a variety of questions, but most of them revolved around the following topics. Is our high praise the reason for our low productivity? One of the things they showed in the video were people being very exuberant and emotionally praising in a church worship service. Again, something that secular humanists frown upon. Number 2 is, why are there so many churches in the Black community, yet so many problems? Well, I don't think one has to do with the other, but asking civil rights leaders is probably not the right question. Maybe asking a question about whether or not those churches are following the tenets of Christianity would be a better question. Number 3, is Jesus answering our prayers? 4, who helped us get to where we are today, Jesus or our ancestors? 5, do you talk to God? And if so, what does he say back? You see, the thing is, again, I'm not here to condemn this worldview of secular humanism. Where I have an issue or challenge is, as a follower of Christ, how do I communicate with someone whose whole philosophy is based on being anti-Jesus? As opposed to, hey, I'm going to jump over here in this lane and just not and be good without God, and I can do that without trashing the church. Is that possible? I mean, because here's the thing. Think about it the way that we talk about anti-Semitic people, and anti-Semitism in public discourse. Do we apply a different set of rules because it's the church, because it's the Black church? How do we do that? And so, but the kicker is actually in the comments on this post. And so I think back to question number 3, which is Jesus answering our prayers? It sounds like an absurd question for someone who's a non-believer, but the kicker's in the comments. Someone commented on this blog post and they said, very interesting and insightful critique of this documentary. I have distanced myself from the Christian church for over a year now. I was a non-denominational Christian, but I always had questions that went unanswered. I now consider myself spiritual rather than religious. Did you catch that? Nobody answered his questions. So what kind of church did he go to where there was no Bible study or resource within the church to ask questions? One of the reasons that I went back to school a few years ago to work on my master's was A, I had questions, and B, people were asking me questions because I'm the pastor's wife. Getting a master's degree is probably overkill for trying to get your questions answered, but that's why No More Silos is here. I hope that I am yet another resource out there to help you deal with the questions you might have about your faith. And so the question for today is, who is Jesus to you? And does your identification and understanding of who Jesus is line up with what's actually in the Bible, what's actually in Scripture, or is it based on what someone just told you about him? If you're a Christian, does your identity as a Christian match what's in the Bible? If you were in a time machine, let's say, and went back to the first century or second century, would people recognize you as a follower of Christ? Would they say, oh, there goes Erica. She's a Christian. I can tell. Like, what did I do that makes you think I'm a Christian? What silos continue to exist in our churches and our society at large today that are keeping us from really following Jesus? So, something to think about. Who is Jesus to you? Until next time, thank you for joining me today on No More Silos. Follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Cultural Christianity and subscribe or follow this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining me, and I hope that this helped you with your faith and answer some questions for you.